back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Great.
Glad to be here.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you a little bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. We're going to send you some links, and then you can click them. You go off the site. We're not paying anyone to rewrite something someone else has already written. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We have essays from critically acclaimed director S. Craig Zoller, and a great little piece by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin about his work with Sally Menke. We'll also have musings by yours truly and great critical voices like Outlaw Vern and Jacob Knight. We are paying good people good money for the content you are enjoying right now, and we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. There's also a free tier if you want to just try us out, but, you know, it's not that much money. Just pony up a little bit. And now on to the show. First up is controversies and non-controversies, and we're going to throw a little bit of a curveball this week by asking whether or not a piece of art has justified its own existence. That's right. We are discussing HBO's Watchmen, which wrapped up its first season last week with an episode in which Ozymandias transported squids to a city in order to maintain world peace and stability. Do I have that right? Have I understood this correctly? There was much hand-wringing over the creation of this show in the first place, with some suggesting that it was unfair to Alan Moore, who has famously disavowed the work since DC refuses to revert the rights back to him. And, you know, some people have just asked, why mess with a perfect thing? Why mess with something that so many people love and have held dear for so many years?
You refer to Zack Snyder's adaptation.
I refer, of course, to Zack Snyder's adaptation of the comic for film, not the comic itself, which is fine. The show has found critical acclaim, however, and it has built an audience. Upwards of 10 million people have so far watched the debut episode across all platforms. So, Peter, let me ask you, was the angst about this production justified?
Not in any way, except possibly by you.
Except
possibly by you, because the only thing this does is show, yet again, just how weak Zack Snyder's adaptation. It's the only controversy here.
No, wrong,
right?
False.
This is an adaptation that actually lives up to its original.
But it's not. It's not an adaptation. It's a sequel.
So an adaptation, a remix is the word that Lindelof used.
That's nonsense. What he said. He was doing that to trick people because this is a pure sequel to the comic book. That's all it is.
It's a straightforward sequel, but it also remixes a lot of the ideas.
It doesn't remix the ideas. It takes the ideas and builds on them, or it subverts them in interesting ways. But it is not a remix of any sort. It's just a sequel. It's literally just a sequel.
It is a sequel, but it also takes the same ideas and same structure. And in fact, if you look at the sort of episode by episode breakdown, you see a similar order in terms of the way that it lays out its story, a similar kind of often sometimes sort of repeating beats in negative. It's a little bit more condensed. There was some speculation by my friend Julian Sanchez online that this might have originally been planned as 12 episodes, just like there were 12 issues of the comic. And I think that seems certainly plausible to me, because if you look at it, it does actually kind of cycle through the same types of story beats that Moore's original comic. I loved this series so much. It's such a good way to kind of expand on a beloved classic. It doesn't simply take the classic for granted. What it does is it says, what was that original about? Let's try and do something different that is still valuable. Alyssa, I think you were like a pretty big fan of this too.
I loved it.
One thing. Does it not though do the exact same thing again in just a like quote unquote clever way with the squid attack?
It's exceptionally clever. I don't think the end is simply a repeat, though. And what I would say is that the way it transfers, the way it adapts its themes, right? So the original was this sort of it was a Cold War story that was really just about superheroes. Alan Moore was telling us that superheroes are fascistic and bad, because that's what Alan Moore has always thought. This is a story that uses superheroes to tell us about the world. Mm. And so it's kind of an inversion of the way that the original comic was mostly about commenting on the genre. This is using the genre of superhero storytelling, which is now in vogue, to tell us something actually kind of interesting and smart about race, police, politics, and also the desire to save the world and how it makes you a bad person.
Alyssa, I'm sorry. I did not mean to interrupt. I just wanted to...
Totally fine. I thought up until the last episode that this was the best season of television I had seen, not just this year, but possibly in several years. Mm. And the episode, This Extraordinary Being, that goes back and sort of retells the history of superheroism, not as sort of the pastime of a bunch of idle rich white people, but as this sort of accidental creation of a desperate black man who survived the massacre in the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is one of the best television episodes I've ever seen in my entire life. And I think that part of what made this so interesting to me is, Peter said, this is using superheroes to comment on the world, but in a way that felt profoundly politically unpredictable, that I think has not fully been appreciated or discussed, right? I mean, this is a story about police officers who wear masks that's fairly supportive of the idea that they should have a certain latitude to be violent in certain ways. It tells that story at the same time that it's exploring race and racism. It has all of these conceits that don't quite land within the preconceived lines of our political debates. And I still haven't quite sorted out what I think about everything that it's trying to say. And it has been so long since I had that experience watching a sort of politically animated piece of art that it was just delightful to be surprised, both in terms of the plot twists, many of which I should say my husband called shockingly early, but also just in terms of not quite feeling like what the creators were saying was quite stable. And that's just not an experience that we have in pop culture for the most part anymore.
At least not intentionally.
Yeah.
Can I I have also struggled with this in a way that I find pleasurable and interesting. You're right that it's not stable. It's not that it's unclear or sort of like muddled. It's just that there's a kind of prismatic quality to it, and that there's a lot of different ideas that are jostling for space. But the big ones that came out to me at the end are kind of encapsulated in this one little line that happens in the third act of the final episode, where Louis Gossett Jr., who has turned out to be the first superhero Hood of Justice, and who's spent his life, devoted his life to fighting crime, but also fighting racism, and gone through all of this sort of travails. He says something at the end that's he was a good man, but he could have done more. Right. And so you combine that then with the way that it portrays Lady True, who I think is the other really interesting character here, because she is the good liberal who is trying to save the world by making everyone by raising a ton of money, having a master plan and solving all the problems and trying to make everyone submit to her plan. This is a story about how like big picture social problem solving fails. But that doesn't absolve us of a duty to make the world a better place. The way you do that is by making yourself better. And that is the obligation that everyone has. And this is a show about how like individuals have a responsibility to fix themselves, not to try and solve all the world's problems.
On Lady True, where I think the show fails, frankly, is actually grappling with what she is doing and why it is wrong. I don't think we ever actually get a sense of her as a monster. Because the only monstrous thing we see her do is blow up a bunch of white supremacists, right? Right? I mean, everything else she says, I'm going to use this power to fix everything. I'm going to fix global warming. I'm going to bring world peace. I'm going to get rid of all the nukes at the same time, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, these all sound like very interesting things. And then she kills all of the white supremacists and, okay, that's, people hate white supremacists. Great. That's fine.
We're supposed to see that as a form of justice.
And we do see that as a form of justice within the show. And that contrasts pretty sharply with Ozymandias, who just kills 3 million people in the book. And is what he does is clearly monstrous. What he does is clearly terrible.
But we're supposed
to
understand that something that she's going to do something that is going to be bad.
But the other thing
is that she wants to become Dr. Manhattan herself, and that's what Ozymandias says. Vite says at the end of this, as he's sort of launching his squids again, is anyone who seeks to obtain the power of a god must be stopped at all costs. I'm very slightly paraphrasing there, but that's like a quote that sums up a lot of what the show is trying to say.
At this. same time, the heroine of the show ends the show by theoretically deciding to take on the power of a god for herself. And the show leaves it ambiguous about whether that has actually happened.
Very,
but
very Lindelofian.
It's definitely in tension with that plot arc. I would say that what happens with Lady True is of a piece of what I think is the show's real significant failure, which is that it does this very interesting thing of moving a marginalized piece of American history and a marginalized group of people to the center of the American story. But then rather than just leaving the margins vacant, it puts Vietnamese people and the American war in Vietnam into those margins. And Vietnam is used as a backdrop in a couple of episodes. We know that Angela grew up there, that she met Dr. Manhattan there. But we don't really learn anything about Vietnamese people, about the legacy of the conflict. We learn in this sort of weirdly cartoony episode in the final episode that Lady True is Ozymandias' daughter, and her mother was a Vietnamese migrant worker about whom we know nothing other than that she hated Ozymandias and artificially impregnated herself with the sperm that he apparently hasn't evolved because
why wouldn't he? Because yeah. He's, you know, I have to say the show felt like it went slightly off the rails once Dr. Manhattan became an active presence as opposed to a passive presence. I think it just totally unbalanced what was going on, and more to the point, it undercut the kind of reality or imagined reality of the rest of the show. Because why would he allow himself to be captured?
Right.
Okay, right. Like, so the reason in the original comic, Veidt thinks he can take Manhattan out is because of the tachyon pulse that the squid throws out. Right, messes up his temporal sense of things, so Dr. Manhattan cannot see anything past that point, and then he uses that to bring him to a machine that disintegrates him. Right now he puts himself back together, it doesn't work, but like there at least it makes sense from a storytelling perspective.
But there's
missing rationale, but there's also just like factually, if Dr. Manhattan can see all of these things happen as they happen, it means that free will does not exist and that he is a complete
free will fate. Is an open question in Lindelofian fiction.
Well, this is, I mean,
and
this
that's
is,
a huge thing that he wrestles with in his stories.
But it's
all
not
the
interrogated
time.
At all in this, and it just kind of happens. I don't know. I liked the show a lot. I thought the last three episodes were weak.
I will agree that the final episode felt condensed to me, but even that is refreshing. This is a show that was 9 episodes long with an extended finale. I think it was about 70 minutes, where I felt like it could have stood to have at least another episode, if not two more. When was the last time you saw a really good serial, you know, prestige drama where you were like, there's not enough of this?
I need more.
Every
yeah.
single one of these shows feels a little baggy in the middle and at the end. And this one actually felt like it was a little bit too tight. And you know what?
I would
That's
push
great.
Back on that because it was just a few months ago that we had the last example of this, which was the idiotically truncated final season of Game of Thrones.
Oh, right. That's true.
Right? I mean,
by the time we got to the end there, I did not
you just
want any more.
You wanted it done.
Fair enough.
Fair. All right. So, guys, I think we all are in agreement here.
Shockingly non-traversial.
Non-traversial. The creation of Watchmen, non-traversial.
It's never been a controversy that Zack Snyder's Watchmen is bad.
How dare you? It is a total non-traversy, and it is a reminder not to judge art before you see it, people. This is one of my hobby horses. I will ride it until I am dead. Do not judge art until you have seen it.
Except that new Christopher Nolan movie, which is definitely great.
Well, that looks like, I mean, that's the best film of the year. I think we all know that. All right. This brings us to the biggest movie event of the year, nay the decade, nay the millennium. Falcon, that is.
Oh.
Do you like that? Do you like that?
Yeah, it was wonderful.
I was waiting for the applause, and I didn't get any. It's very sad. That's right. Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker is here. Who were Rey's parents? What's Poe Dameron's deal? And that's apparently a thing we were wondering about. I don't know. How can we politely sideline Rose Tico without hurting anyone's feelings? And just how much of The Last Jedi can we safely ignore? Turns out the answer is most of it. The Rise of Skywalker is interesting in that it functions more or less as a direct sequel to The Force Awakens. You will remember that that is not the most recent Star Wars movie. That it is not even the most recent Skywalker saga movie. That's The Last Jedi. Aside from one or two scenes and three or four more offhand references, you really don't need to have seen The Last Jedi to know what's going on here. The Rise of Skywalker is getting trashed by critics who cannot stand that it has subverted our expectations by ignoring The Last Jedi. But Alyssa, you wrote a pretty scathing review of this picture for the Washington Post, even though you also did not particularly care for The Last Jedi. Why did you hate this so much?
Oh, God, it's so terrible.
That was actually, for people who did not read her Washington Post piece, it was just that. It was that for like 800 characters.
Like 750 words, yeah. No, it's, I don't, so I love Star Wars. I love Star Wars in a way that is probably embarrassing for a 35-year-old woman with a child to confess. I own a bunch of the Expanded Universe books. I had a...
Yeah, that's the embarrassing part.
I had a pen pal who I used to trade Star Wars fan fiction with. Like, it's real bad. And this movie is so bad that it makes me question whether I actually liked Star Wars in the first place or whether I just, after a pop culture-deprived childhood, liked being young and plugging a Hollywood product into my veins for the first time. For a movie that cost a fortune, it looks real bad, especially in the climactic sequence. Like, it's not even really a fun spectacle.
Murky and dark and muddy.
Yeah, and just sort of like 10 years old to a certain extent.
It looks pasted together. You just see all the seams in the composite shots, and it looks like the effects guys just they had to kind of turn in their work a month early and didn't get to do the last couple of renders.
Yeah. The script is, every single line is written and delivered not from one human being to another, but to the audience. I mean, this is literally a movie where there's a subplot about a spy. The person who is the spy takes actions that reveal him to be the spy. And then he says out loud, "I'm the spy."
Like, I'm the spy.
I mean, just, what is this garbage? It's so just amateurly made. And this is before I get into any of my sort of nerdy garbage about whether or not this is true to the characters or the ideas or whatever. It's just, it's so incompetent and stupid.
Can I suggest one thing? That ideas in Star Wars are overrated?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say in the original trilogy, the idea is good versus evil.
Yeah,
like, that's
100%.
That's the only idea. And there's the other idea is soap operas are fun and cool, which is like basically the long and the short of it. The prequels, frankly, the biggest problem in the prequels is the idea behind it. And this is the lack of thought that went into them, I think, is what has spawned.
Wait. Are you saying trade disputes aren't an important national issue?
I'm just saying it's not interesting. And and the ways in which George Lucas has framed them, like, make a pretty convincing case that the Empire was good. So, like, ideas there have been a negative. And this is probably, frankly, the best thing about The Force Awakens, is that it does not actually bother with any of that. It just kind of, it goes on. And I would push back a little bit on the idea that these things need to be, like, intellectually interesting, even. Like, frankly, even interesting.
No,
even
but they need to be, I mean, the original sin of The Force Awakens is that you have four substantial new main characters who are meant to carry this franchise forward theoretically, and one and a half of them over a course of like, what, 8 hours of movie is actually developed convincingly as a human being, and that's Kylo Ren.
Yes.
Right?
Well, totally. I mean, this is, I'll get to what I like about it in a minute. Peter, what are your thoughts here?
I absolutely hated this movie. It is the worst Star Wars film of it is the worst of the nine Skywalker films. It is the worst Star Wars film. And I really, really didn't like Solo, I think, more than even a lot of other people. I think that so I wrote a piece arguing that there was no real idea at the core of it, but I wasn't talking about political ideas. I wasn't talking about it doesn't comment on society. In fact, The Last Jedi does a bunch of that, and I think a bunch of the way that it goes about it is bad and makes it not makes it a weaker film. But there is a core story to the original trilogy, And that story is the idea. An idea is a story is a form of an idea, right? It's that here's a kid who like learns, who finds himself, who gains power, right? And yes, of course, it's all hero's journey stuff that we're all very familiar with it now, but it's an idea about how human beings sort of develop in the world and relate to each other. It was a really well told, really fun, really engaging, and actually fairly simple story. And that's part of the problem here with the Rise of Skywalker is that J.J. Abrams can't tell a simple story. Well, he can't. He's just a terrible storyteller, I think, in many ways. But he's really bad at telling a simple story and letting moments and bits breathe. So there's just so much hectic plot in this film, and even when a scene needs to sort of just take a moment to stop and breathe and let the characters relate to each other, Abrams will always insist on having some other thing come in and interrupt them in the middle because he is just terrified that the audience will be bored for even a millisecond. And so in the end, he has created a boring film because none of it actually matters. There's no ideas, no story, no characters. I didn't care about any of it. I was thinking about this. I didn't like the movie while I was watching it, but it's been a couple of days now, and I cannot think of one nice thing to say about this movie. There's not one thing that I liked, one positive thing that stuck out. It was bad in every possible way.
Adam Driver is pretty good in it.
Adam Driver manages to escape terrible material without having embarrassed himself. That is not a good thing. It's merely the best thing in the movie.
But to be fair, that is not true of Oscar Isaac, who going into the Star Wars trilogy, I thought was going to be like the person who had the career that Al Pacino should have had before he just decided to start making a lot of money.
And he signed up for what was basically the Harrison Ford part.
Yeah. And he is, like, the material is bad, and he does not improve it.
I would also say that the original Star Wars, the idea that it's just good versus evil, yes, that's the thematic idea. But it's this crazy synthesis of about 57 million different influences, from Akira Kurosawa to World War II dogfight films to like all sorts of 1970s hippie spiritual stuff. No, but these are influences and so these are components of George Lucas's completely bizarre collage that somehow came together into something that was super compelling to millions and millions of people.
Sure. I mean, J.J. Abrams, I guess, would his fault is that his base of reference is just the Star Wars movies. It is not. I'm going to play devil's advocate here and push back on some of this insofar as, again, if you view this movie as more or less a direct sequel to The Force Awakens, which it basically is, what ends up working the best is the arc of Kylo Ren, the arc of Ben Solo, the idea that nobody is beyond redemption, that he is still able to pull himself back from the edge and sacrifice himself for the greater good and for somebody who he actually clearly loves. I mean, it's never stated, out loud, but he is clearly in love with Rey, and he gives his own life for her.
And that's the part that of The Last Jedi that works sort of the best, is that sort of growing relationship and the chemistry, but also, frankly, learning a little bit more about why he is the way he is. I mean, he has suffered this kind of primal betrayal. I mean, he thought the person that was supposed to be mentoring him was going to basically summarily execute him.
Mm-hmm.
And that shading, and again, that moral nuance, is the best part of The Last Jedi. It's the part that's probably most in keeping with the sort of Han Solo, Lando Calrissian arcs in the original movies, but a little bit more grown up. And it's done really well. Mark Hamill is good connective tissue there.
Yeah. There is a machete cut style version of these films where you basically could watch The Force Awakens, just the Kylo Ren and Rey and Luke stuff from The Last Jedi, that like 40 minutes of film.
Mm-hmm.
And then more or less just that stuff again from this. And it's like a pretty decent like 5-hour miniseries, or 4-hour miniseries. But here, you know, another thing I will say that J.J. Abrams actually understands how to use some of these characters properly. For instance, C-3PO, actually funny in this movie. the C-3PO stuff got laughs in my audience, which I was kind of surprised by. A lot of the, like, kind of, you know, creature cantina design stuff is still very good in this movie.
I thought it was much worse than in The Force Awakens and much less memorable.
You just want to go to Alien Burning Man.
It feels... Well, I mean, there's the Alien Burning Man, but there's also the little droid guy who, you know, talks in the pigeon English that was kind of funny and
serves
amusing.
What purpose?
He has to get C-3PO to say the Sith words. He has to get the C-3PO to say the Sith words, but also wipe out C-3PO's memory, so we get more great C-3PO humor with R2-D2. Best part of the movie, C-3PO.
I just felt like all of these random excursions are, in some ways, in keeping with how Star Wars often works. It's a little bit episodic. You sort of go from here to here and meet new characters. But the way that Abrams structures and directs all of these scenes really doesn't allow any of them to land or to become memorable and iconic in the way that even the worst scenes in the original Star Wars trilogy just stuck in your head. And I was thinking today while I was walking about Return of the Jedi and Return of the Jedi is very clearly the weakest of the original trilogy. And yet you can, if you've only seen it once, but also if you've seen it 1,000 times like I have, you can recite beat for beat every little bit that happens, even in the kind of the throwaway opening sequence with Jabba the Hutt, right? The monsters there are super memorable, the Sarlacc pit monster, you know, and the Rancor. I guess there was a giant snake at one point in this movie. Why was there a giant snake? I don't remember.
The giant snake actually did serve a storytelling purpose. It's actually one of the more clever beats because
it
shows
magic and she can heal people. Now.
It shows that you can use the Force to transfer your own life force into somebody else to heal and save them.
And then at the end, they take down a Star Destroyer by riding on its hull with Shetland ponies, basically.
And
it looks terrible, for one thing, and it's not in any way... like
it's literally fan art. It's Princess Mononoke on a Star Destroyer.
But, however, I will say that...
And there's no tension to that sequence, either.
I will say that John Boyega has more chemistry with the actress. I don't know who that actress is, but John Boyega has more chemistry with her than Rose Tico... by about a billion watts.
Or with Daisy Ridley.
Daisy Ridley.
There's this completely bizarre hanging subplot where he's about to confess his love to her like 47 times, and then it never
it's
happens.
It's not
and
hanging. We're going to find out how it resolves in the Disney Plus show.
They have these awful hugs in both the end of Last Jedi and this. They have these weird, like, awkward hugs like you would give an aunt.
You mean they're not going to end in, like, some sort of polycule?
It's really just... Once again, all of the relationships outside of anything to do with Kylo Ren are bad and make no sense.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there. Okay, guys. Well, I think we know how everybody's going to come down on this. Alyssa, did you like this movie?
I would rather dissolve for 1,000 years in the Sarlacc pit than watch it again.
Peter, you were a big fan.
I didn't like the movie, but I would probably watch it rather than the Sarlacc pit. I don't know. It would be a tough choice, though.
I have to say, coming out of the theater, I was like, this movie is dumb and bad. And I think it is still probably bad, but the more I've been thinking about it, the more I like it. So I'm just going to go thumbs up on general principle on the theory that this will grow on me as the years go along,
like mold on cottage cheese.
And finally, we turn to assigned viewing. Up this week is Pain and Gain. Alyssa, why are we watching Michael Bay's bodybuilding heist movie masterpiece?
Because of four words you will not hear on any other podcast: Michael Bay auteurist masterpiece. Pain and Gain is Michael Bay's movie about. And this is shockingly, overwhelmingly true. A trio of bodybuilders who decided to scam and murder their way to a really, really tacky version of the American Dream is, to my mind, actually one of the best movies of the last 10 years. I think it is, but it also sets up his... forthcoming movie. I guess it's on Netflix already. Six Underground. Streaming for your pleasure on Netflix if you want to see Ryan Reynolds destroy Florence.
We'll get to that next week. But for now, Pain and Gain. Now, Peter, you were watching Pain and Gain with your father, is that right?
Yeah, we're watching it with a parent. So my dad's an English professor.
Yes, I just wanted to let the people know what he does.
My dad's an English professor. If I come by my monologues about storytelling genetically, One of the things that I had forgotten was just how gleefully vulgar this movie is. And it's not that I wasn't aware of it, but it's really, I think of this movie as the key to understanding Michael Bay as a director. Because this is the movie where he lets you know he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's kidding, and also not kidding. All at the same time.
There well, is also this... that he can control what you're seeing, right? I mean, he is, you know, Michael Bay is the guy who just like women's butts, lens flare, cars, you know, thing, blood spatters.
Yeah.
And he is letting you know in this movie that 100% he knows how to frame a shot and direct a scene so that you will either be like, this is awesome, or recognize how horrifying what something is. It's just, it's an amazing statement of skill, but it's also just fascinating because what he's basically saying is, I can make movies this way, and I am choosing not to 95%
yeah. So he, of the time. It's the tastelessness in this movie has been intentionally amped up
and weaponized.
Yes, in a way that is very knowing and also a little bit awkward with your you know, Mennonite son of a pastor father. But my dad appreciates these sorts of things. So if you remember in the Transformers movies, there are like jokes in which John Turturro at one point gets effectively urinated on by a giant robot. And this is the sort of thing that Michael Bay just is constantly putting in his films. In Bad Boys 2, there is a whole chase sequence in which dead bodies are dumped out of the back of a truck. And that becomes sort of the object that has to be dodged in the chase sequence. This is a common Michael Bay chase scene formula, which you know, one car following a truck that is throwing stuff at the car behind it. And you might get the impression in watching those movies that Michael Bay is just kind of a tasteless, vulgar idiot. And in fact, he's a tasteless, vulgar, really smart person.
You don't get to... Well, this is the thing, though, right? Is that nobody denies that he is talented at a very specific sort of big, brash, yep, grotesque filmmaking. And you don't get to be the best at something unless you're actually kind of smart. Even if that intelligence is on a more visceral, less intellectual level.
But he also has, weirdly, this is the movie that sent that I think Pain and Gain, despite being having its sort of vulgarity quotient amped up further than virtually any of his other films, it's also the movie in which he shows that he has a kind of soft moral center. And that is when the Ed Harris character, the detective who discovers all of these people and they're, you know, sort of out there, not the detective, the private investigator, I believe, who figures out what they're doing. Ed Harris shows up and he's just such a calm and decent presence, and it lets you know that Michael Bay knows you need, at some point about midway through the movie, you need a break from all of the awfulness, which is about to get much more awful as the movie progresses. And it is a way of letting you know that actually he has like a soft side and understands like what a decent person is and isn't just a sort of amoral, clueless vulgarian.
Well, and it's also interesting because the main victim in this movie, played by Tony Shalhoub, is himself sort of spectacularly unlikable. You can see why Mark Wahlberg's character, Daniel Lugo, resents the way that Tony Shalhoub's character sort of looks down on him and condescends to him and insults him and kind of trashes the values that Lugo holds dear, but that aren't really working out for him. And Ed Harris's character comes in and sort of is like, you can hate this guy, and in fact, he is sort of blown off by the Miami Police Department and ignored despite being terribly victimized. But you should, you know, he has a right not to be, you know, beaten and burned and hung like dry cleaning and crashed in his own car and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real sense of empathy in this movie that I think you could overlook in other Michael Bay films, but in fact is there.
And it's kind of fascinatingly empathetic to everyone in the movie,
yeah,
right? I mean, it's empathetic to Lugo, who is like this totally, he's this avatar of American dumbness, right? He is, you know, totally convinced that he's like working his way to the American dream when in fact all he's pursuing is sort of shortcuts and cheats. It's completely sympathetic to Dwayne Johnson's character, who is this, you know, temporarily sober, ultimately born again, super violent giant. It's incredibly sympathetic to Adrian Dorball, Anthony Mackie's character, who has erectile dysfunction. It's just like, it's weirdly sympathetic to everybody.
This is
in a way that's fascinating.
This movie is fascinating to me on a number of levels because it is a movie about America in the same way that Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather is a movie about America, right? This movie is a movie that posits there is a warping effect in telling people that if they work hard, they will achieve success. That hard work does not necessarily mean success will follow.
Well, and there's also a warping effect when we sort of lose definitions of success and hard work,
yes.
Right? I mean,
right. Right, right. And,
like,
and
defrauding elderly people in investment schemes may take effort.
Sure, sure. No, exactly. But exactly. There's also something to be said about the way America perceives itself. And I say this as somebody who quite likes America, believe it or not. I'm pro-America. But there's a fascinating... I have this weird kind of under theory about this movie that I've been kicking around for a long time. That the film is essentially about America in the 1990s. America in the 1990s is enjoying just unbelievable peace and prosperity. So it, like, keeps... getting involved in things that it maybe should not necessarily get involved with, and it keeps building itself up and pumping itself up, and, you know, gets bigger, badder. There's a world policeman theory in here somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with it, but it is this idea of America at a moment of unparalleled bigness and badness, and how that can kind of go off the rails if you're not shoring it up with an actual belief system.
But it also captures these tensions that would explode into American politics 2 years after Pain and Gain came out, and that in fact were percolating in the country in the mid-90s when these crimes actually happened, and that there's this intense resentment and anxiety and envy sort of driving this dynamic between people in two different classes who live in proximity to each other, but in fact very far apart. And the movie captures that incredibly well. And while it's not at all sympathetic to what the Sun Jim Gang does in pursuit of sort of closing that gap, it is sympathetic to that feeling of being sort of constantly less than.
Yes. Yeah.
At the same time that it reaffirms some sort of basic values. I mean, I think it captured something really important, and I do think it will be sort of rediscovered that way at some point.
It is a film about the resentment that income inequality engenders. I have another long-standing theory that income inequality does not itself actually matter. Income inequality only matters when your face is rubbed in it.
Yeah.
And this movie is all about what happens when you rub somebody's face in it who can take you apart with a China. What does he call the chainsaw? The Chinese-made chainsaw, I don't know, it's a piece of junk from Home Depot. I'm a huge fan of this movie. I think it has depths that we as a society have failed to really grapple with.
When everyone else discovers the greatness that is Pain and Gain, we will be the oracles.
Yes,
having your face rubbed in inequality is kind of what Miami is all about.
Yeah,
as far as I can tell, and so in a lot of ways, Michael Bay's take on Miami in the same way that a lot of Martin Scorsese's 70s movies were his take on New York is that Michael Bay's primary residence, as I understand it, is in Miami, and he splits his time between there and California. And so a lot of the movie takes place in sort of these glitzy Miami locales, and it is about Miami body culture and the weird things that happen within that in a way that is... that is quite knowing.
It's also just an insanely quotable movie, to be clear. My personal nominee for the best line in it is Rebel Wilson's character talking about her grandfather and declaring, "He's dead now from racism." Just kidding. It was a cement truck.
This is the only movie I like her in, by the way.
She's very, very good in it.
That's because Michael Bay is weirdly an actor's director who gets incredibly good performances out of character actors who he just gives this super long, like, remember Frances McDormand was in the Transformers movies?
Yep.
And she was
John
great.
Turturro.
And Turturro, right. Yeah. Like, who else casts Frances McDormand and the John Turturro?
Who played Drunk Merlin?
Is Stanley Tucci, Stanley who was Tucci, also right, in the fourth Transformers movie in a completely different role that has nothing to do with Drunk Merlin.
Yep.
And he's, I mean, he is the only directors who get character actor performances consistently as good as Michael Bay or the Coen Brothers.
Michael Bay and the Coen Brothers, same. All right, that's it. We've gone off the rails. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. Lots of you have done so far. Really love it. Glad that you guys are signing up. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you love the show, please tell your friends and review us. Eventually, we'll be on Apple. I don't know what the holdup is over in Cupertino. We need those reviews, people. And if you don't love it, complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.